Welcome to this Forthright Radio for October 4th, 2014, the 60th anniversary of the launching by the Soviet Union of Sputnik 1, the first artificial satellite, which triggered the space race. I'm Joy LeClaire, and our guest today, Professor Alfred McCoy, writes of this and much more about the history for global dominance in his latest book, In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power, just published by Haymarket Books. Alfred McCoy, who holds the Harrington Chair in History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, has been shaking up our understanding of beliefs about the role of the United States in the world since 1970, when he co-edited Laos, War, and Revolution. His research led him to publish The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia in 1972, which led to his testifying before the Foreign Operations Subcommittee of the Senate Appropriations Committee in June of that year about the role of the CIA in the production and distribution of heroin. Among his numerous other books are Policing America's Empire, The United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State, and A Question of Torture, CIA Interrogation from the Cold War to the War on Terror. In 2012, Yale University awarded him the Wilbur Cross Medal for work as, quote, one of the world's leading historians of Southeast Asia and an expert on international political surveillance, end quote. We welcome you to Forthright Radio, Professor Alfred McCoy.
A pleasure to be there.
In your latest book, In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power, published by Dispatch Books of Haymarket Books, you do a history more or less beginning with the Spanish-American War and following the rise and what you say is now a period of decline of an American empire. Would you please begin by talking about empires? You write there have been 70 in history, but we here have a consciousness, many of us in America, that America is an exception to that rise and decline wave that every other empire in history has gone through. So tell us what is meant by empire and what are these phases?
First of all, there have been 70 empires reaching back over 4,000 years of world history. They are a constant feature of a human civilization. The United States is, in the view of many scholars, particularly British scholars of empire, who don't share our restraint about using the word, is the richest and most powerful empire in human history. So empires are a constant. Now why did America's deny their status as this powerful, this wealthy empire? A couple of reasons. More immediately, during the Cold War, which is synonymous with America's rise to global power, our enemies, the Soviet Union, used the Marxist-inflected term imperialist to stigmatize America as a global power, condemning us as being exploitative, self-interested, etc. And so quite naturally, American historians, particularly under the ideological and political pressures of the Cold War, when everybody is loath to be branded communist or anything of the like, they said that we were an exceptional power, and they came up with a doctrine of American exceptionalism. And they said, except for our very brief and limited flirtation with colonialism in the Philippines after 1898, we had never been an imperial power, we were a world leader, we were a superpower, but never an empire. And it was our enemies, the Soviet Union, the ones that had the empire that Ronald Reagan labeled the evil empire. More deeply, I think that taps into a kind of a strain of American civic religion where we see ourselves as kind of a latter-day chosen people. And we believe that everything we do is somehow benign or beneficent. More immediately and more convincingly, it's the Cold War that led to American denial. And once the Cold War came to an end, right across the political spectrum, particularly after the 9/11 attack, after we got immersed, mired in the Iraq War after 2003, Americans of all political persuasions who were thinking about these issues began using the term empire as the most fitting descriptor of this extraordinary wealth and power the United States had accumulated. And that term came into use really about the time that there was deep concern that not only were an empire, but we might be a fading empire. And that's been the subject of a lot of debate and discussion.
Another way of thinking about empire is that there's a gradual rise to global power and then a gradual decline. Certainly, when you think of the Roman Empire, that involves centuries. But you point out that after 400 years of colonial expansion, after World War II, the European colonial powers collapsed in 25 years. Could you briefly describe the 400 years of colonial expansion and then how quickly it just disintegrated, creating almost 100 new nations?
Starting in the 16th century, we see the rise of the Iberian empires, two quite extraordinary empires. The Portuguese had little enclaves, trading forts, 50 of them, spanning the tropical latitudes that ringed right around the globe, from Brazil all the way to eastern Indonesia. They didn't penetrate much inland, but they were very aggressive in dominating the sea lanes and capturing the trade, plundering cities that they captured. The other major empire, of course, was the Spanish, which was quite different. They had a formal alliance with the Catholic Church, and they were very much interested in territorial colonization. And they built their great empire in Latin America and a somewhat smaller one in the Philippines. And then in the 18th century, we see the rise of two dynamic merchant capital nations, the Dutch and the British, later the French come in as well. And again, it's a merchant empire of trading forts and ports that's concentrated in Asia and along the coast of Africa. Then in the 19th century, there's a fundamental change in the nature of empire. These Europeans move out of their coastal enclaves, and they move into the vast interiors of Asia and Africa and Latin America, and they set up formal state enterprises, kind of surrogate states, colonies, or trust territories, with viceroys and governor generals. The British ruled over a quarter of humanity directly through colonies of various kinds, and another quarter of humanity through an informal empire. The French controlled about 10% of the world's population. One British imperial historian summarized the British process very neatly. He said that for 200 years, the British Empire expanded inexorably through the cooperation of local elites. By that he meant chiefs in Fiji, sultans in Malaya, maharajas in India, emirs and chiefs in Africa, etc. These local elites were willing partners of the British Empire. He said, as long as they cooperated, that empire expanded. And then after World War II, their cooperation, their collaboration changed suddenly as the idea of empire died to non-cooperation and resistance. And once that happened, the mighty British Empire that had ruled over a quarter of humanity directly wrapped up in the space of 20 years. The American empire, the American hegemony, rose simultaneous with the decline of these six great European overseas empires that gave rise to 100 new nations. And for us, the axial point, the lever of imperial control, moved upward from those local districts where the sultans, the maharajas, and the chiefs had collaborated with the British and French to the presidential palaces of 100 new nations around the globe. And these presidents and prime ministers became the new subordinate elites in America's global hegemony. And our power was synonymous with their power. Our power rested on these presidents and prime ministers, just as the British Empire had rested on the cooperation of sultans and maharajas.
What you have been describing has primarily been a naval, sea power, coastal phenomenon, but in the early 1900s, Hafford Mackinder, you say, invents geopolitics. What was his invention, and what is the great game?
Halpern Mackinder was then head of the London School of Economics. And on a cold London evening in January 1904, he gave a lecture that not only described the world island, but also, in that single lecture, invented the entire study of geopolitics. That's to say, the study of the intersection between international influence or power and geography. And what Mackinder said was, first of all, that there weren't three separate continents. That when you looked at the globe a certain way, you would see that we're, in essence, a unified landmass that he dubbed the world island. Europe, Asia, and Africa. Europe, Asia, and Africa were not three separate continents. They were a unitary landmass that he dubbed the world island. He said that for four and five centuries, Europe had dominated the world island because they had learned to sail around it, and that had given them, an agility and a strategic advantage against the landsmen, the great hordes, the Mongols, the Manchus, the Turks, and the Arabs that had pounded at the gates of Europe for the better part of 1,000 years. And European imperial power, indeed the rise of their great empires, was synonymous with sea power. But he was speaking in 1904, and everybody in that audience knew that there was a major event that was changing. The Trans-Siberian Railway was crawling slowly for 5,000 miles across Moscow all the way to Vladivostok, and it was changing this fundamental reality. And Mackinder said that when more railways were built and when a new power would arise in the heartland at the center of the world island, in basically the center of Russia, that there would be a shift from sea power to land power, and a new world empire would arise. Well, of course, Mackinder's prediction didn't happen for a long time, for a century. I mean, a lot of things intervened, two world wars, and then the Cold War, which dropped a line of division right across the heart of the world island, divided this unitary landmass. But then, beginning in about 2007, China, with its $4 trillion of profits from world trade, much of it with the United States, actually began laying down a trillion-dollar infrastructure of railroads and pipelines and gas lines that actually realized Mackinder's vision, world island, of unifying what is basically a single continent. Europe and Asia are one giant land. It was only the distance, the emptiness at the center, that really separated them into two continents. They were a unitary landmass. China began laying down this trillion-dollar grid. Earlier this year, they held a major conference in Beijing in which they committed themselves to another $1 trillion in infrastructure. Last year, they set up the Asian Infrastructure Bank, okay, which was creating a financial apparatus for the sustained investment in the world island. And by the time that opened in 2016, it had 57 member nations who had contributed $100 million, which is half the capital of the World Bank. So China is very serious about developing the resources of Eurasia. Moreover, they're expected by, about 5 years from now, to have $1 trillion of capital invested in Africa. They already have three times the trade of the United States with Africa. In effect, via infrastructure, trade, finance, investment, China is realizing Sir Halpern Mackinder's original 1904 vision of the world island. And that is changing world politics in the most fundamental way imaginable.
Let's continue with talking about the rise of China at the same time that in your book, In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power, you document the ways in which the United States is in decline, and particularly in comparison to China. We've talked about the landmass, and perhaps we'll go back to that. But let's talk about the South China Sea and what's happening there.
China's strategy, such as we can divine it, for its global ascent is twofold. One, the investment of these trillions of dollars in the infrastructure of the Eurasian landmass, the trade with Africa, to turn Europe, Asia, and Africa into that world island. Second, China is countering the U.S. strategy for control over Eurasia. The Oxford historian John Darwin wrote in his historical survey of 1,000 years of imperial rivalry in the Eurasian landmass that the United States became the most powerful empire in the history of the world because it became the first empire to dominate, to control what he called the axial ends of the Eurasian landmass. That's to say that after World War II, the United States established the NATO alliance in Western Europe that gave us geopolitical control over the western end of the Eurasian landmass. And then in 1951, we established our control over the eastern end along the Pacific littoral, an island chain running from Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, all the way down to Australia, through four bilateral treaties, mutual defense treaties with each of those four powers. And then in the decades that followed, for the next 60 years, the United States, if you will, laid down circles of steel ringing the Eurasian landmass, joining those two axial points of control. And they were mutual defense treaties, NATO in the West, all the way to the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, the Australia-New Zealand Treaty, and the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty, etc. Next, the United States created massive naval fleets, the 6th Fleet based in Naples for the Mediterranean and Atlantic, the 7th Fleet based in Subic Bay, Philippines for the Western Pacific, and then in the 1990s, after the British pulled out, the 5th Fleet based in the Persian Gulf at Bahrain. Our latest sort of circle of steel has been over the last 10 years. The United States has built 60 drone bases stretching from Sicily in the west all the way to Guam Island in the western Pacific. And these bases have drones, Reapers, Predators, Global Hawks that can surveil and can rocket virtually anywhere 1,000 miles north or south of that circle of steel. And China has come up with a very clever strategy, if you will, of slicing through those circles of steel that the United States has laid down around the Eurasian landmass. Beginning about 2014, they started dredging 7 atolls, building 7 artificial islands in the Spratly Islands in the heart of the South China Sea. And they laid claim to virtually the whole of the South China Sea. That's one of the major arteries of commerce around the globe. And that would give China an enormous chokehold on international commerce. The next thing they did was in 2015, President Xi Jinping went to Pakistan. He announced a $46 million initiative to lay down a road, rail, gas, and oil pipeline corridor from western China all the way to the Arabian Sea in western Pakistan. And there China had spent $200 billion in transforming a sleepy fishing village at Gwadar into a modern port. And then just last year, the Chinese also got rights to a naval base in Djibouti. So with their base at Djibouti, their base at Gwadar, they now have access to the Red Sea and the mouth of the oil-rich Persian Gulf. And through their presence in the Arabian Sea and the South China Sea, they are slicing through the circles of steel the United States has laid down around the world island, and that has been the basis of our global power for 70 years.
You also chronicle in your book that they have become the largest investor in Afghanistan.
Yeah, they're the largest investor in many countries around the world now. It's all part of their systematic campaign to use trade and investment in order to build up strong bilateral ties with many of the nations that comprise this massive landmass, the world island of Europe, Asia, and Africa. They've become major investors in Greece, basically control commercially the main Greek port of Piraeus, which is the end of their Silk Road, their One Belt, One Road strategy, their European beachhead. The Chinese are in this tricontinental area. They're omnipresent. They're industrious at all kinds of levels. To a sustained campaign. And the only American leader that seemed to understand it and came up with a strategy to counter it was, of course, Barack Obama. I regard former President Obama as something of a geopolitical genius. He's one of the very few Americans that understood the this fundamental fact of geopolitics and had a strategy for checking China's rise.
Please expand on that and support that assertion for our listeners.
President Obama was, I think, one of three American geopolitical geniuses over the last 120 years. The other was, of course, the national security advisor to President Carter, Professor Zbigniew Brzezinski. Brzezinski was a student of Mackinder. Brzezinski played upon Mackinder's theory of geopolitics to smash the Soviet empire and shear Eastern Europe away from Soviet control. Obama was the next in this slender succession of geopolitical geniuses. And he came up with a very clever strategy for checking China's rise. Two parts. First, Obama decided that given the fracking and the petrochemical boom in North America, that we were now self-sufficient in oil, and we therefore had no further serious strategic interest in the Middle East. Yeah, we wanted to maintain global stability, sure. It was no longer our primary focus. So Obama committed himself to what he called the pivot to Asia, and he began transferring surplus U.S. forces out of the Middle East towards that eastern axial end of the U.S. control over the Eurasian landmass. He also diplomatically rebuilt our alliances with Japan, South Korea, the Philippines. He concluded a treaty that gave the U.S. forces access to five Philippine military bases. He conducted negotiations with Australia, which is where he announced his pivot to Asia in 2011. And in 2014, there's a Marine battalion and Navy ships that are now based at Darwin in northern Australia, and that gives them ready access through Indonesia to the South China Sea. The other thing he did was that he came up with a bold trade strategy for draining the Eurasian landmass of its commercial lifeblood. He negotiated two important trade pacts, the Trans-Pacific Partnership with a dozen Asia-Pacific nations that control 40% of world trade, and he also was negotiating the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership at the western end of the Eurasian landmass with the European Union that had about another 20% of world trade. Those two trade pacts, if they'd gone through, would have redirected 60% of world trade, draining Eurasia, draining China's would-be world island, and moving that trade across the Atlantic and the Pacific away from China towards the United States. And the combination of these two elements, one, a shift in naval forces to the Pacific littoral off the coast of Asia, and two, these trade pacts to take away the commerce that's the lifeblood of the would-be world island, was a bold geopolitical strategy that maybe wouldn't have perpetuated American power for a half century, but it certainly would have given us a much longer lean on that power, and it would have slowed the rise of China considerably for a decade or two. But of course, that's all ashes now.
Well, I can just imagine some of our listeners exclaiming irately at the radio at this point. Many of them were very, very much against the TPP and less so about the European trade deal. This brings up the issue of whether it's good or bad. The United States has to contend with democracy. China, not so much. And I do want to inquire, making all these investments, how do they buffer themselves against the insurgencies that the United States has encountered in trying to invest? For example, let's use Afghanistan or Pakistan as an example. You document in your book the billions and billions of dollars of investments in Afghanistan in particular that just melts away with corruption. How does China deal with that same thing?
China practices a very focused realpolitik. In their relations with nations in the world island, they make no judgment about human rights. They have no concern, obviously, as a communist dictatorship, with democracy. They forge realpolitik tactical alliances with who's ever in power that serves their interests. Since their singular interest is cash and carry, investing money, getting a return, or getting resources from their ventures, like mining in Afghanistan, like a port facility in Pakistan, they're not concerned with ambit issues. So they, with a laser-like focus on each investment for its target and resources, strategy, or return on investment, the Chinese do fairly well with their investments. And if they take a loss, it's a political loss that increases their influence and gives them another goal, another objective accomplished. They're not caught up in the morass, the mess of Afghanistan. If the Taliban were to come to power again, the Chinese would deal with them. That's not their concern. They have a certain kind of advantage as a global power that the United States doesn't have. And that's part of their strength, too.
Let's make a big shift. Your book that came out in the very early 70s, The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, really changed my life. It opened my eyes to what you call the covert netherworld in your most recent book, In the Shadows of the American Century. Let's talk about the covert netherworld for a bit. You start out talking about the aggressive promotion in the 19th century of the free trade in opium, and then with Theodore Roosevelt, the absolute prohibition of all narcotics, and how that has just spun the whole world into a tizzy. There are lives at stake. But please describe how that has affected global politics.
For two centuries, from the 18th to 19th century, the rising imperial powers, the Dutch, the British in particular, promoted a free trade in opium. The British ran regular auctions in Calcutta, which was the heart of their Indian Empire initially, and British merchants and Indian merchants smuggled opium through the Straits of Malacca, across the South China Sea, all the way into southern China, and there was a massive boom in opium. China tried to prohibit it in 1840, and Britain fought two wars against China for the right to import opium into China. Then in 1900, as a result of global religious movements led by Protestants, Quakers, and others, the British government decided that they would begin a process of prohibiting opium. The United States joined that crusade in 1909 through President Theodore Roosevelt. An American Episcopalian bishop, Charles Henry Brent, chaired the Shanghai International Opium Conference. That was the start of our global drug diplomacy. By the 1920s, the League of Nations, precursor of the United Nations, had a treaty banning essentially the non-medical use of heroin and opium. And we've had a prohibition regime now for illicit drugs for about 100 years. And what this did on a global level is basically what the prohibition of alcohol did in the United States for 13 years from 1920 to 1933. It simply shifted the manufacture, the importation, and sale of alcohol from legal tax-paying merchants and breweries and the like, distillers, to criminal syndicates that made vast fortunes. And it transformed the criminal syndicates from petty thugs in local neighborhoods into national and international crime bosses. Well, the prohibition of narcotics has done the same. It's created, according to a UN conference that was held on the floor of the General Assembly, it's created an illegal apparatus of transnational criminal syndicates with about 3 million members worldwide. They control about 4% of world trade. The UN estimated that the illicit traffic in world trade is greater than the legal commerce in textiles. That's extraordinary, because textiles are, along with food and shelter, one of three essentials for human survival. So illicit drugs is now bigger than the trade in textiles. It's extraordinary. This happened really most intensely in the aftermath of World War II. The United States, through the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, practiced a kind of international drug diplomacy under President Nixon. We fought the first of our drug wars against heroin in the Mediterranean and in Southeast Asia. Under President Reagan, we extended that to coca and cocaine in Latin America. The net result was that after World War II, you had this massive mushrooming illegal commerce in narcotics. At the same time, you had the rise of intelligence agencies as important adjuncts of global power. Britain, France, the Soviet Union, the United States all had very active intelligence agencies, and they were operating covertly, that's to say, with fabricated identities, with off-the-shelf commercial operations to conceal the movement of money. And in this netherworld of illegality and invisibility, these intelligence agencies found that there was one other group that was also practicing the clandestine arts, the criminals. And very often, they formed alliances. The United States found that the illicit traffic in drugs could become a useful adjunct to increase the power of its surrogate warfare allies. So in the 1980s in Afghanistan, the Mujahideen increased the opium production in Afghanistan from 100 tons to 2,000 tons. The CIA, by its own admission, turned an absolute blind eye because this gave the Mujahideen followers, the peasants who grew the crop, were selling it through them and were thus loyal to them. It gave them an additional income that sustained that resistance for 10 years, sufficient to drive the Soviet Red Army out of Afghanistan. In Central America, same thing. The CIA allied with the Contra guerrillas to try and harass and break the Sandinista regime in Nicaragua. And the agency turned a very willing and knowing blind eye to the alliance between the Contras and some major cocaine smugglers in the Caribbean. The largest cocaine smuggler in the Caribbean, a guy named Alan Hyde, who was based in the Bay Islands of Guatemala, for 5 years allowed his warehouses to be used by the CIA to provide arms to the Contra guerrillas. And the agency protected him from any kind of investigation for 5 years, even though he had an estimated 35 ships on the high seas smuggling cocaine from Colombia across the Caribbean into the United States. Yeah, in 1991, the Sandinistas lost an election and fell from power. So again, the cocaine and the illicit income fueled the sustained decade-long Contra resistance and allowed the CIA to accomplish its objective. Of course, there was a lot of collateral damage from that. There was a lot of fallout from that. Afghanistan, by the end of the U.S. support for the Mujahideen guerrillas in 1992, was providing between 75 and 90% of the world's illicit heroin supply. And, of course, much of the U.S. cocaine supply was being smuggled through Central America. So there was a cost, a very real cost. But in realpolitik terms, the capacity of the CIA to manipulate that covert netherworld and increase its power accomplished two major covert warfare objectives: the expulsion of the Red Army from Afghanistan and the defeat of the Sandinistas in Nicaragua.
And you also point out that at the same time, the prison population in the United States increased untold numbers of times. I believe the latest figure, it's over 3 million U.S. citizens are in jail, a very large number of them for supposed drug offenses. And the political control that gives to, well, frankly, the Republicans for the most part, but not only the Republicans. Not only are they in prison, so they're not part of the workforce, but in most states, they are no longer allowed to vote. So that has a drastic impact on the democratic process here.
Judge, let's pause. I'm not endorsing it, obviously, but in hard-nosed political terms, that's part of the genius of Ronald Reagan's strategy in the 1980s. He created a moral crisis over cocaine use. He increased the penalties for possession for 50 years from the 1930s through the 1980s. The U.S. prison population had been one prisoner per 100,000 population. When Reagan brought in his Get Tough on Drug laws, it began climbing, and it's now over 700 prisoners per 100,000 population. It's the highest in the world by far. It's gone from 100 to 700. It's increased sevenfold directly as a result of the Reagan drug war. It's about 6% of African-American males are in the system in ways that denies them the vote. And the second thing you get, of course, is the prisons themselves. The prisons are generally located in rural areas where the prisoners are enumerated. They count in terms of votes, but they're not allowed to vote. And the guards, who are very conservative, are concentrated in the prisons. So you create the effect of kind of rotten boroughs, of these pockets of electoral imbalance across the country that reinforces subtly Republican conservatives. It's a stroke of political genius. And it's not surprising that under this very conservative Republican administration, after President Obama began addressing the inequity in sentencing and began releasing nonviolent drug offenders from the prison, it's not surprising that the Trump administration has absolutely reversed that policy, announced a get tough on drugs, a crackdown, increased incarceration. Works for Republican conservatives.
Since you brought up the Trump administration, I think perhaps we should explore that a little bit. You've spoken a bit about Obama's attempts at being a grandmaster of geopolitics. What would you say so far of the Trump administration in terms of our analysis of geopolitics?
Trump, both as a candidate and as president during his, first 9 months now in office, is acting as almost if he has some kind of malign design for the systematic demolition of the pillars of U.S. global power. Remember I said that the fundamental strength of U.S. global power lay in its control over the axial ends of the Eurasian landmass, NATO and Western Europe, and those four bilateral mutual defense treaties along the Pacific littoral at the eastern axial point of Eurasia. Trump has conducted a systematic demolition. First of all, he's attacked Obama's very skillful geopolitical strategy for checking China's rise. During his first week in office, President Trump announced that the Trans-Pacific Partnership was dead. He canceled it over the objections of Japan, which said, Prime Minister Abe of Japan said, but China has an alternative treaty with 16 nations, a regional cooperation pact. They're going to scoop up all the trade. There's going to be a trade pact. It could be ours or theirs. Well, it's going to be theirs now. And Trump didn't listen to Prime Minister Abe, unfortunately, from a geopolitical perspective. So that was the first thing. And then when he visited Europe in May and went to NATO headquarters, President Trump very publicly refused to affirm the mutual defense commitment, which is the key to the NATO alliance. He systematically denigrated NATO. He's weakened NATO. NATO's much weaker now than it was before Trump took office. Trump has damaged relations systematically with those four Asian powers that are the basis of our position in the Pacific littoral, the powers that Obama courted so sedulously during his second term in office. For example, we have the transcript of the phone conversation that President Trump made to the Prime Minister of Australia, Malcolm Turnbull, during Trump's first weeks in office. He gets almost into a kind of slanging match against Turnbull, insults him, and slams the phone down. That reverberated across Australia with political shockwaves in ways that we don't understand in this country. Australia, by the way, has been one of America's loyalist allies for 100 years. 100,000 Australians have died fighting in America's wars, World War I, World War II, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan. They're still fighting. They still have troops in Afghanistan with our troops. When Trump insulted the Prime Minister of Australia, polls that showed that 45% of the Australian population favors shifting to China as Australia's primary ally, economic and diplomatic. That's an extraordinary change. And Trump's treatment of Prime Minister Turnbull accelerated that trend. During his campaign and in office, President Trump has set out to systematically denigrate South Korea in just about every way possible. He called them once, he says they were once a part of China, which is actually not quite true, but it's also an incredible insult to a very proud culture. He has called the South Korea-U.S. Free Trade Agreement a bad deal, and he wants to get rid of it. The insults from Trump grew so extensive that earlier in the year, the current president, Moon Jae-in of South Korea, campaigned on a slogan of say no to America. So that's damage. And then, of course, the cancellation of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty and the tensions over the North Korean nuclear arms are weakening very rapidly our relationship with Japan. Then there's the Philippines. The Philippines has been one of America's strongest and closest allies for 70 or 80 years now. 1 million Filipinos in a population of just 16 million people died fighting for the United States and suffering for the United States during World War II. And then during the Cold War, the Philippines was the site of the biggest U.S. naval base outside the United States anywhere in the world, Subic Bay. It was a very close American ally. Well, speaking of transcripts, we have a transcript of a conversation from last April between President Trump and President Duterte of the Philippines. President Duterte is a very controversial figure because he's launched a drug war that's killed in excess of 8,000 people. Bodies dumped on the streets of Manila and provincial cities. So the transcript starts with Trump congratulating President Duterte on his drug war. And then the conversation is very significant. Trump says, oh, we got this problem with Kim Jong-un in North Korea. And Duterte says, yeah, well, yeah. Trump says, we've got two very powerful nuclear submarines right in that area. Duterte says, I'm going to call China. Trump says, we've got 20 times the nuclear power of North Korea. Duterte says, I'm going to call China. Trump says, we've got cyber warfare. We can stop them with our cyber warfare. Duterte says, I'm going to call President Xi Jinping tomorrow. In other words, the Philippines is gone. Despite the amity between Trump and Duterte as sort of fellow populace, the Philippines is gone. So the American position along the Pacific littoral is crumbling faster than most Americans can believe. And that's critical, because that's not only our axial point for the domination of the Eurasian landmass, it's also the western perimeter of the defense of the United States.
You brought up cyber war, and I would like us to go there. We in this country like to think of ourselves as the absolute leaders in technology. And perhaps for a while we were, but your explorations of the issue indicate that that is either not any longer true or won't be for long. Would you talk about cyber war and also space warfare and how they're interconnected, and particularly this new technology that China is working on of photon satellite communication as opposed to radio communication?
A couple things. First of all, the long-term trends seem to be favoring China emergence as a major technological innovator in ways that 10 years ago was utterly unimaginable. The statistics are really quite amazing. For example, in the race for worldwide patents, in 2014, China surged from third place to first place with nearly half the world's total, filing an extraordinary 801,000 patents compared to just 285,000 for Americans. Moreover, in 2010, China's Ministry of Defense built the world's fastest supercomputer, and for 7 years, China has kept producing the world's fastest supercomputer. Last year, they finally produced the fastest in the way that really matters, with microprocessors with chips made in China. And now China has more supercomputers than the United States. They have 167. We have only 165. The next is Japan, which only has 29. And supercomputers are very important for not only sophisticated design, but for code breaking, for commercial products. They have all kinds of uses. This advantage is very significant in that area. And then looking forward into the future, say 2030, which is my date for basically the end of U.S. global power, there are some very negative trends. The Rich Countries Club, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, runs these things called PISA tests. And they test every couple, 3 years, about 500,000 kids worldwide, 15-year-olds. In 2012, Shanghai came first. Kids in Shanghai came first. Americans placed 20th in science and 27th in math. 3 years later, in 2015, we slid further to 25th in science and an utterly appalling 39th in math. You could say, okay, so who cares about a bunch of, you know, 15-year-old kids with pimples, braces, and backpacks, not to mention the attitude? Well, in 2030, those 15-year-old test takers are going to be the mid-career scientists and engineers, the smart young scientists and engineers who are going to decide who's got the fastest supercomputer for code breaking, whose satellites get shot down and whose economy produces the next best thing. So not only are the numbers bad now, but they're likely to get worse in the future. So that's the long-term trend with technology. Obama, as a part of his very clever recalibration of U.S. global power, revealed his shift in the focus of U.S. defense posture during the 2012 presidential debates. It was quite a famous moment. I think most people have kind of forgotten it, his debate with the Republican candidate Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney complained that the number of our capital ships was down, and Obama said mockingly, yeah, we don't build battleships anymore, and we don't fight with bayonets that much anymore either. He said it's really a question of our cyberspace and aerospace capabilities. And what Obama has presided over, it's been in development before him and after him, the Pentagon, specifically the DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Administration, the Defense Department, the kind of venture science operation, they're conducting a massive shift in U.S. defense posture into aerospace and space warfare with a whole new generation of aircraft drones, drones like the Predator and Reaper in the atmosphere, and all the way out to the X-37B space drone that was launched in 2010 and is likely to be an armed drone in space in the near future. China is engaging, I think, in a kind of asymmetric strategy. They can't hope to match our massive armada of bombers and bases and aircraft carriers in the near future. But they can strategically figure out what the weakness is in our total apparatus. I think they have. And our weakness is cyber warfare and satellites. And China is pushing very far into space. Not only are they building up their conventional forces, but their rocket forces are, their missile forces are really quite impressive. They have a global missile reach akin to ours. In 2007, China began experimenting with space warfare, and they shot down with a missile one of their own satellites that was 500 miles above the Earth. And that was a signal to the Pentagon that the era of space warfare or future space warfare had begun. They're very much concerned with communications security. If you build a satellite network and you do as the United States has done, you put all of our what's called the three C's, command, control, and communications of all of our naval, air, and ground forces into those satellites, then you've got to secure them from hacking because they're transmitting signals from ground to satellite and back again all the time. Unless you have satellite security, unless you have communication security, somebody can hack in and compromise your communications and the control over your weapon systems. What China's done is they're the first, it looks like they're the first to develop the technology for photon light transmission from unique transmitter receivers that's basically impervious to hacking. That means that in a future war for control over computers and satellites and all of the communications, everything for our the navigation of our ships, or a pilot's ability to fly the F-35 at supersonic speeds, all of that depends on satellites. And who's got more secure communication with their satellites is going to win. And China appears to be taking the lead already.
Do you know if DARPA, for example, is also investigating the use of this photon technology?
I'm sure they are. I'm just not privy to that. If they are, it's probably highly classified. DARPA came up with their own system about 10 years ago, and it was called the F-6. And the idea was is they would protect their satellite system against rocket attack, which they knew about because of the Chinese 2007 test. The Chinese could actually shoot down a satellite in the sky. And they came up with what they called the fractionated satellite system. So instead of a massive, hulking, modular unit, they would take the components and they would scatter them in space. And they would have backup components. And so instead of a single satellite, you'd have these parts or components floating around in space, communicating with each other via microwaves, radio, basically radio wave communications. And then if one component failed, there would be already a backup component floating around out in space that could kick in immediately. Or if somebody shot out component A, well, then there was an alternative component that would immediately come online. So they were smaller targets and a more agile, more resilient system that developed technological and cost problems, and the Pentagon has since abandoned it. And they've gone back to launching these hulking, modular, single-unit satellites that are basically sitting ducks in space waiting for either a Chinese hack or a Chinese rocket in the event of a 21st century war of cyber warfare and aerospace warfare, which is where I think the next war is going to be fought, should there be one.
It sounds all too much like the defeat of the Spanish Armada by the smaller, swifter British ships. We're at the end of our time with you. There's so much more in your book, In the Shadow of the American Century. What do you wish to say that we have not already said?
There's no question. Every empire has its time, its rise, its time of glory and dominion, and its decline. And we've presided over 60 years of comparative global prosperity. Global poverty has dropped enormously. Income levels are up around the globe. We've had our excesses, but we've also stood up for human rights and women's rights. There's been a lot of human progress in our 60 to 70 years of global dominion. And it's important to Americans, and indeed to the whole world, that as our power fades, it fades slowly and in a controlled and managed manner so that we can preside over the transition to a world order that reflects the very best of American values, these human rights, the rule of law, the respect for international sovereignty, the use of negotiations and arbitration to avoid international conflict, avoid wars. If we manage this, we can, one, extend U.S. global power. We can have a managed transition economically and politically to a more multipolar world, and we can preserve an international order that represents the lasting legacy of American values. If we bungle it, if we mismanage it, as this administration is doing so, the consequences for the world and the United States are going to be quite serious. Economic contraction, global conflict, the rise of harsh realpolitik powers like China and Russia that do not respect democracy, human rights, civil rights, the rule of law. It will be a less pleasant, less free world that could emerge. So these are serious issues, and we need to start thinking about them.
Thank you for your many decades of work, sir, and this latest book, In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Joy. You know, like all radio listeners, and I'm an avid listener to Wisconsin Public Radio, 3-4 times a day, you know, I kind of hate pledge drive. You know, instead of getting my news and local commentary that I depend on, I get the pitch. But I contribute because I understand that my contribution, small though it might be, adds up along with everybody else's contribution that keeps public radio on the air and keeps this very important source of real news, you know, available to anybody in an automobile and a factory floor, in a farm, in an office. We all have access to it all day long, and it keeps us, you know, kind of on the same page, sharing information, sharing news, sharing views in a way that's not all angry and acrimonious. And, you know maybe we'll get us beyond, help get us beyond this really bitter bipartisan, this bitter partisan divide that we're in right now. So, I donate here in Wisconsin, and I hope you do the same in your community as well. Because the particularly annoying part drives me nuts. No, I know you got to do it, right? Suck it up and pay. Well, look, thank you for those questions and that thoughtful reading of my book. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome. I can't thank you enough.
Oh, sure. It's a pleasure, Joy.
Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production broadcast each first and third Wednesday of the month from the Philo Studios of KZYXNZ, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting, listener-supported community radio. Engineer Rich Culbertson. I'm Joy LaClaire. The views and opinions expressed on Forthright Radio are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of KZYX and Z staff, its members, board of directors, or contributors.